Welcome, I'm Mikko Heskala. In this podcast, we discuss service, service economy, and the service production and productivity with Professor Paul Lillerank. Paul, could you shortly introduce yourself?
Thank you, Mikko. Yeah, my name is Paul Lillerank. I'm a professor of quality and service management. I've been here for 26 years, since 1994. Before that, I was at the Stockholm School of Economics. Before that, at the Boston Consulting Group. And in the 1980s, I did my doctoral studies in Japan about quality management in Japanese industry. So for the past 15 years, I've been focusing on healthcare, studying health service production systems.
So let's begin with service economy. What is the service sector and in the macroeconomic sense?
We divide the world into sectors so that we could understand it better, like, say, the political sector, the civil society, the economy, and so on. The economy typically is divided in three big slices. The first is extraction and agriculture, which means that we extract something from nature, or we make nature produce something by growing or animal husbandry, or by forcing bacteria to produce, like, say, beer or fermented milk. That's one, but the extraction part produces raw materials that usually are not consumable as such. So then comes the question about producing things, and that's manufacturing, where humans build various artifacts that are basically molecules put in a certain order. Then we have the service sector, which is immaterial in many ways, and that's why a little difficult to grasp sometimes. But basically I say that services are things, deeds, actions that create some value to somebody, and because they have some value, they can be traded. So you can buy and sell services, and in that respect, they're part of the economy, but they behave a little differently than manufactured products.
What kind of examples could you give about different kinds of services?
Typical big service sectors are trade, so wholesale and retail. So your a grocery shop is not producing anything. It makes things available and it changes the property rights of certain things. And the production in that sense is just sort of making things available, displaying them and transporting them before that. Then there is banking and finance, which deals with money. Then we have these things like media, information, education, and then the health and welfare sector. Then travel and tourism, and various kinds of amusement and recreational service. So these are the big categories of services. And typically we do not include public administration because that's not market-based. It's based on political power and legislation. So that has to be seen as a different thing.
So that sounds like there's a lot to services. So how does the whole service sector compare to the manufacturing and the agricultural raw material production?
Well, if you look at on the world level, or let's say the advanced countries, then services as of GNP are somewhere north of 70%. And then that means that we calculate the value of traded services as percent of the value of everything that is traded. So that's quite a lot. Man, agriculture in advanced countries employs about 5% of the labor force, and manufacturing perhaps 10, 20, 15, depending on the country. So services are the big employers and the big creators of revenue.
Okay, so service sector is by far, that sounded like it's by far the biggest sector in the global economy, at least in terms of gross domestic product, GDP, and share of labor.
Right.
Why is that?
the historical origins in this are, of course, very complicated, but basically you say that most things in the world are driven by technology, so technological innovations, and we of course talk first about new products and new production systems, but also new ways of financing and distributing and transporting things. So agriculture used to employ more than 80% of the labor force up till the 19th century. Then there were a lot of innovations in using mechanical power or fertilizers and better knowledge about various plants that led to the fact that a lot of agricultural labor were not needed anymore, so you have a situation with surplus labor. And people have to do something when they are not needed in the agriculture and on the farm anymore. At the same time, incidentally, there were a lot of innovations in manufacturing that started the Industrial Revolution, starting with, let's say, cotton and then iron and steel, steam and so on. And these new manufacturing sectors then could employ the surplus labor that was left out from the farm. And the same kind of thing has been going on all the time, that when manufacturing productivity and efficiency has improved, so there's less need for traditional blue-collar labor, and then these people need something to do, and some other people come up with various innovations, and I believe there's no limit to what kind of innovations you can make. And when people have money, they have time at their hands, then the human desires are basically endless. So as long as there is some kind of demand and you have something interesting you can do or for other people, then there is a situation where you can start a service business.
This sounds like it brings up to the topic of productivity. So how would you define, or what is productivity, a short definition?
Productivity is the most important thing in economics or the economic world. Productivity means the relation between input and output. So how much effort and resources do you throw on something in relation to the what do you get? And when productivity improves, it means that we get more for less. So typically productivity is looked in quantitative terms, so we get more stuff or more services for the same amount of resources spent, let's say like labor or capital or raw materials or energy or so things like that. Then there is also, of course, the qualitative improvement that has an impact on productivity. So basically input, output. And the thing there between is the production system, and when productivity improves, you get more with less. And that is the driver of economic progress. Economies can grow, of course, if you draw in more labor or more capital, or dig deeper and extract more minerals from the ground. But these growth factors have their limits that are reached in many places on the earth. I mean, we cannot extract very much more, and the labor pool is soon exhausted. But productivity can basically keep growing as far as human beings have any creativity left in themselves.
But you said earlier that the service sector is by far the biggest sector in terms of labor and GDP.
Yeah.
But then the manufacturing and the agriculture are, you know, there's a lot less people employed in those sectors. What did it tell us about the productivity of the service sector?
That is the core question, indeed. The problem with the services and service productivity is that up till recently, productivity in services has not been growing very rapidly. And from that follows, then obviously, that if the share of services of national economy grows, so the overall growth rate of the economy slows down because you have this huge amount of services where productivity is not improving very much. And this is the first part of a phenomenon known as Baumol's disease. It's after William Baumol, who was one of the most prominent economists in the United States. He passed away 2 years ago. Unfortunately, I mean, he should have deserved the Nobel Prize. William Baumol noted this first thing, that productivity growth in services is slow. Services grow as a part of the economy, from which follows quite obviously that the overall growth rate of economies slow down. Okay. Then the second point has to do with the cost of labor. Now, services tend to be labor intensive. Then the question is, how much do you pay for the labor? Now, in a free market economy, with a free labor market, then it is the productivity leaders, which means here manufacturing, and that also are the wage leaders. So they can pay higher salaries to people because their productivity is going up and up. Now, this means competition on the labor market. So service employers have to raise the wages so that they by and large match the wage level in manufacturing. This, of course, is not a perfect match, and it might take a while, but by and large, the wage level in a society cannot be too broad. So from this follows then that service labor becomes expensive, and by that, services also become expensive. So we have a situation where the relative price of things change. So how much you have to pay for a service compared to how much you have to pay for a physical manufactured product. So in this sense, services have become more expensive, relatively speaking. And from this then follows a number of things, like people don't consume services as much. So like, say, domestic help, which used to be a very big part of the service sector 100 years ago, that's almost disappeared. And then because of the cost pressure, many services are automated, rationalized away, or sent offshore, in offshore outsourcing. Or then we have seen the growth of, say, a service proletariat, sort of Mac jobs, as they are called, where there are service jobs, particularly in the, say, fast food or the delivery industries, where people have to work for reasonably low salaries and do not come anywhere close to the manufacturing salaries. And this obviously is because there are not that many manufacturing jobs available anymore, so the price or wage competition is not as intensive. So this puts a lot of stress on society in many ways, that there are services that people would want, but they are too expensive to have. One solution to this problem in the Nordic countries has been that many services are publicly financed, so the public sector takes care of, let's say, nursing and childcare and many other things that are market-based in some other countries, and this to the effect that people don't have to pay the price of, let's say, care of small children, and that's why they consume things that they basically themselves could not afford.
Of course, hiring service help would be just too expensive.
Yeah, most people couldn't make that. So this is Baumol's disease that has implications for economic policy making, particularly in the welfare state, brings up the question that how much public services can we really afford, and how much can we afford to pay to the people who are doing these services. And there's a sort of continuous pressure in the labor market from, say, let's say, assistant nurses and daycare personnel to get more paid, but then somebody has to pay it. So this equation is difficult to solve. But then, of course, come to a question that why is productivity growth difficult in services? Well, William Baumol started his inquiry in this topic by studying music performance. And he observed that you have, say, a stroke quartet that plays Beethoven. The productivity, meaning how many people do you need, how much time do you need to produce one piece of music, has not changed, almost not at all, since the time of Beethoven and modern days. So this puts a limit on productivity. I mean, if you go and tell this string quartet to play 10% faster, then that would destroy the music, and it would be basically very pointless. So this brings us to the question of services that cannot be made more efficient without destroying the value of the whole thing. The same is true for, let's say, physiotherapy or travel and tourism. I mean, if you want to go for a vacation for 2 weeks, and then the travel agent says that, no, we have made this more efficient, so it's only 10 days, same price. So no good deal
at all. Doesn't make sense at all.
So there are services that are very strictly connected to the personal labor of some service producer, and that puts a limit to how productivity can grow. So these are personal services. Think of, say, hairdressing, therapy, many medical services, advisory services, and the like. But these are obviously not the only services around, and also for these services there is a difference between the service encounters and the service production system. By service encounters, we mean the situation where a customer and a service provider meet in person, and whatever service is done is then executed in that encounter. And then to make this more efficient would require some kind of technical innovation in the very basic thing that is done. Of course, these kind of technical innovations are not impossible. If you think of, say, physiotherapy, so it's typically thought that the length of the session has an impact on the results. So it's 20 minutes, 45 minutes, 1 hour, and so. But assume that there will be a new technology, like there are some sort of electromagnetic pulses or things that could, say, open up the knots in your muscles, then it might be possible to get the same effect in 5 minutes. So then that would mean there would be an innovation in the basic production technology that is used in producing that service. So, or in, say, healthcare, there was some years ago a very major innovation called Losec. It's a pharmaceutical that treats gastric ulcers. This problem was previously treated surgically, which means a major piece of surgery, 2 weeks in a hospital, and a quite big risk. Now you just pop a couple of pills and you get the same effect. So these kind of innovations are possible.
So it's not all doom and gloom for services then. So there are some services that are not doing poorly, or am I right?
Yeah,
I guess there must be some services that are using technology or otherwise.
Yeah, that's interesting that we've seen for over the past 10 years or so that there are service providers that have been making tremendous improvements in productivity, even more than manufacturers. So the question is really how they are doing it. And I believe that this comes back to the very fundamental question in all production between what is known as processing and setup. So processing means the activities that change a state of affairs. So if you go to a physiotherapist, when the thumbs, dig into your muscles, then that's processing. That changes the state of your muscles. Or in surgery, when the surgeon cuts up your body and do something inside, that's processing. But before any of these things can be done or started, there has to be quite a lot of preparations. that you have to haul your ass to the place wherever you need to go. There has to be a lot of cleaning, instrumentation. And then there is the mental or the cognitive setup that somebody has to decide what needs to be done. And in personal services, that typically means that you have to discuss. If you go for a haircut or your physiotherapy, you have a small chat with the service provider that, okay, sir, what kind of haircut do you want this time? Or no haircut
well,
at all.
Looking at me, I used self-service technology at home.
So these setups can take a long time. They can be very complicated. So there is a cost to the setup. You have to engage labor. You have to engage customer in doing the setup. And let's say if you have complicated medical situations, then the setup might take 10 times more time than actual processing, because the cause of the medical problem might not be easily found out, and the process of diagnostics is essentially preparation and setup for the cure. So now we have an interesting dynamics here between the cost of the setup and the cost of the processing. And this dynamics in manufacturing has been exploited to the hilt. The productivity improvement in manufacturing is partly based on the fact that in manufacturing you can do the setup. Say you set up a machine and feed it with raw materials and things, and then you press the button and it goes and makes 10,000 repetitions. So it is doing the processing thing 10,000 times. But it's doing the setup only once. So it means that you can recycle, so to say, the setup, and then the cost of the setup can be sort of distributed to the 10,000 pieces that are produced. So this means that the more you produce, the cheaper it gets. And this is economies of scale. It's a sort of real cornucopia of capitalism, meaning that the more you produce, the cheaper it gets. So that's wonderful. But the mechanism behind it, as I said, is the relationship between the preparation setup thing and then the actual processing. There are other issues with the economies of scale also. There are physical scale economies, like say blast furnaces has to be of certain size to be thermodynamically efficient. But basically it's this setup to processing ratio that drives productivity improvement in many ways. So now comes the question in services. I believe that many of the highly innovative service companies have been working hard with making the setups more efficient. Now, in personal services, you always have some kind of setup as long as the service is personal, because the service provider has to sort of greet the person and ask, so what do you want this time and what's your situation, blah, blah, blah. So this kind of setup takes some time. But if a thing to be done is not highly personal, or the personal aspect of it can be quantified or formalized somehow, then there is the possibility of changing the setup into what's called a formatted setup. So think, for example, banking services. Well, banking is personal. I mean, it's your money, it's your bank account, it's your life, it's your living quarters, your debts, your everything. It's highly personal. It's only you. Nobody else in this world had exactly the same kind of financial situation as you do. But beyond that, you don't want to start talking about your personal life with your bank clerk. It's limited to very sort of narrow sector in your life. And these things can be dealt with by using a limited number of variables. So what is your income? What is the interest rate? Do you have loans? What is the interest on that? So the whole world of your personal finance services can be formalized into a set of numbers.
Yeah, so that's basically just information that can
be collected. Yeah, just information. And there are certain rules and algorithms how that information is dealt with, from which follows that everything can be standardized. So you can standardize all the elements of the service. And if something can be standardized, if not totally, then to a great extent, if it can be standardized, then it is possible to turn it to self-service. I mean, you cannot turn to self-service things that are non-standard. Because then, you know, all these customers would come and screw up everything if they would have to make too much judgment by themselves. But if there is nothing to judge, the thing is pretty clear, then the whole services can be automated and turned to self-service. So automation, standardization, automation, and self-service should go together. And then, of course, if we push a lot of the service production cost and time and effort to the customer, then quite obviously productivity improves. And this is what has happened in retailing in the big way. In retailing, if you think of the transportation cost, it's the last mile that is the most expensive one, because then you have to transport very small amounts of things.
So that's the most customized part of the
process. The most customized part. But now when Walmart and all these players, they make huge centralized mega stores, and then people have to travel to these places by their own car, paying their own gasoline and carrying these things with their own hands and feet, then the retailing industry sort of outsources the most expensive part of the whole thing to the customers. And most people like this very much, because the prices can be lowered and you can get something to do on the weekend. But this is an example of how automation, semi-automation, can be used to improve sales. Just think of, say, airline industries. I mean, you don't need a travel agent anymore. I mean, you can get your ticket, you can pay for it, you can get down to the seat in an aircraft without having too much interaction with anybody. I mean, you have the security control, but it's not necessarily part of the on the service, but you need one or two people you need to meet before you sit down in the seat.
So there's definitely opportunities to improve service productivity in a lot of sectors, in different service sectors. That's what I gather from your...
Yeah, I think that's definitely true. There are enormous opportunities here, the opportunities increase as people's education level and experience and ability to use information technology improves. And you can also make the argument that in many services, people want to be engaged. And being engaged is it's nice. It's part of the thing.
You would go to a nice restaurant, for example, and being pampered by the waiters and...
Yeah,
like
and if you think of, say, the many services where you can do the preparations and the setup, or let's call this the service design, you can do yourself. So you design your own service from elements that are available. So think of the travel thing. What gives you status? If you buy a package tour to Spain, to a beach with booze and sunshine, and poolside parties, and then you come back and you write about on Facebook, I think you will get a lot of admiration from other people around here. Not a lot. I mean, because that's a low end of travel and tourism. But then if you invest a lot of time and effort in finding out some nice treks up in Tibet, And you really do the research, and you go there, and you use whatever local transportation, and you interact with the local people, and you go to places where white men never been before. So you can brag about that. So the value of that service for you personally would be extremely high, but the cost would also be very high. I mean, the time and effort to design this kind of travel service, and then of course a certain amount of risk that you may have to take when you go outside the beaten track. You always take risk that something nasty can happen to you. But anyway, use this to illustrate that the ways the service customer can start interacting with service providers is a sort of limitless field of innovations.
So we've been discussing the services and discussing a lot of different kind of examples from different service sectors. But what are services or how they've been understood in the service research? I think there's a few examples of that, or many viewpoints to that.
Somebody said that service is something that you cannot drop on your foot. So it illustrates that defining a service is not obvious in the same way as defining, let's say, a product of agriculture or a manufactured product that you can see and touch and feel it. Before the modern world, the services were not part of the economic circulation at all. So if, for example, Adam Smith, writing in the 18th century, thought that services should not be included in the economy at all, because services were typically, you know, performed within social relation, within the family or community, and they did not left anything to circulate further in the economy. But anyway, in the 1950s, when the service sector started to grow, and services obviously were part of the economy, because, you know, people were buying and selling services and getting rich doing it. So there was a need to define this part of the economy more precisely. So the first major definition is what we call the ISIP definition, where it stands for immaterial, heterogeneous, inseparable, and perishable. So this definition says that the service product or the accomplishment of service is immaterial, so there are no molecules. The heterogeneity means that every service is different. As we just discussed, this is true with personal services, because there has to be some interaction between the service provider and the customer in every instance.
So there's customers and also service employees that may be different.
Yeah, they are also employees are different. So it's human interaction. So that creates a lot of heterogeneity. Then the second eye, inseparability, refers to the situation where services are produced and consumed at the same time. So then you're thinking of, let's say, music performances, that the production and the consumption happens in parallel. And then there's the P, the perishable, which means that services cannot be stored. So you cannot build an inventory of services. So if you're an airline company, you cannot, say, make flights and then put them in inventory and then sell flights. You have to fly the aircraft then when people want to move. So in that sense, there is no inventory in services. Instead of inventories, you have to manage capacity. So that was the basic definition that is still quite dominant in the mainstream service and particular service marketing literature. And this definition is in many ways true, but it's also in many ways a little problematic. Namely, the question of the immateriality. I mean, if you think of, say, dental services, and you go to have a root canal job done, it hurts like hell. It don't help thinking that this is all immaterial. It's highly material in your sensory perception. And then the heterogeneity thing, well, yes, but there are many manufactured things that are extremely heterogeneous. Think of just of tailored suits. If you go to Savile Row to get a double-breasted suit, it's going to be a unique piece of tailoring. And inseparability, well, I'm not quite sure of that. If you think of getting the haircut, so the haircut is produced, well, you have to be there, but when do you consume your haircut? I think you consume it then when you walk out from the place and show off your nice style to everybody and impress on the ladies. the perishability thing, well, that applies to many manufactured goods also, and fresh fruits and cut flowers and rubber gloves in hospitals. So the ISIP intuitively is correct, but it's not clear, and it don't cut very clearly. So you can always question whether something belongs or does not belong. But anyway, then the second approach is linked to the ISIP, but that's the idea that services are state changes.
What do you mean by that? State
the state of affairs changes somehow. And then you could make this distinction that in manufacturing and extraction, you sort of create new molecules. Something that has not been in existence in the world comes into existence when it's produced in a factory. But that comes back to the difference between a car factory and a car repair shop. So car factory produces new cars, but the car garage is repairing existing cars. So it changes the state of the existing product, that it was broken and now it's fixed. So in the same way, because it's a cleaning services, it's not immaterial in the sense that, molecules are moved. That's what cleaning is all about. You move molecules from a place where they should not be to another place where they could be. So it deals with molecules, but they're not new, creating new molecules, only changing the state or the location of the molecules. So that the state changes. And then you can think further locations. So transport services, you are now standing at the bus stop, it's raining, and you're hungry, and you need to pee, and you want to be home. And then comes a nice Uber taxi, and it takes you home. So the state is changing the state, your location, and your physical and mental state is changed as a result of a service. But no new molecules are produced. There's no artifact remaining from these things.
And the customer is then paying somebody for a desired change in the state of
your affairs. Help in changing the state. And the same is true in healthcare. If you're sick, you have a broken bone, you pay somebody to fix your broken bone. And no artifact is created, but the state of your body is changed. And in education and entertainment, the same is your state of your mind, your knowledge, your cognitive capabilities, your experiences, your amusement, your excitement level and things like that change. So I think the state change perspective is important here because it helps to make the difference between the car factory and the garage. And it also helps to think of how the immaterial service product can be known. So how do you know that something immaterial but valuable has happened? Well, the state of some affairs change, and then if you know the starting position, you standing in the rain in the bus stop, and you know the subject value of the end situation where you're at home, that difference can be quantified by market forces, meaning that you, depending on how much money you have, so you are willing to pay a certain sum of money for that change of state. So from that follows then the possibility of putting value on all services. I mean, like anything in the market is valued simply by you ask how much you want to pay for this.
Okay, so there was IHIP and state changes. And it sounded to me like it's the state change happens in a some kind of a process.
Yeah, there's a process, of course, that changes the state. There are quite very few state changes that happen just like that. You have to go through a number of steps in order to accomplish the state step. So from this, you can come to the third approach to defining services, and that has to do with the process or the production system. So there is this school of thinking called the service dominant logic, which says that services are defined by the fact that they are co-created. So it's something valuable is accomplished through the cooperation of the customer and the producer. So this is different from manufacturing. In a factory, it's the factory employees that produce the thing, and then they put it on a truck and it goes to the retailing system and you can buy it. So you don't interact with the factory as a customer. You can, of course, then tell them that you like or you don't like their products, but by and large, you don't participate in the production. So the service dominant logic says that this is the key issue, the participation of the customer in the creation of value. So another way to express the same basic thing is the idea of resource integration, RI. So customers and producers integrate their resources into something valuable. So this is a definition that focuses on the production system. And now, if customers participate in production, then and they will want to express their heterogeneous preferences and wants and wishes, then from that follows quite obviously that the production system cannot be closed. The production system needs to remain open for the inputs from the customers and the particular situations that might change this way and that way. And you can go back to the productivity improvement in manufacturing. A part of the story in manufacturing is that the production systems can be closed. And that affects the fact that there are not disturbances to the manufacturing process. So you don't manufacture, say, foodstuff in an open air place. But you have a building, you have barbed wire around it. Not everybody can walk in there. You have very strict hygienic procedures where you take out the microbes from the air so that they don't spoil the milk. And so you produce in a closed environment. That reduces variability in the process and makes it possible to apply then standardization and specialization and all these things. So almost all manufacturing is done in closed or semi-closed system. And even things like, say, construction. In the old days, construction was a very open system, so you could see everything. But nowadays, many of the construction sites are closed in the sense that you cannot enter and they are covered by various tarpaulins and other things in order to make it easier to concentrate on doing what needs to be done inside an enclosure. So here there is an important variable, namely how open or how close is service production production system in general. So rather than there's a talk about goods and services, at least from an industrial management perspective, the more interesting thing is that how open, not how closed, is the system. If it's closed, then you can assume that you can have good control over what happens there. If it's open, then you have to live with the assumption that many things can happen and the initial assumptions might change and there might be some contingencies. And in any way, customers are all different and they bring their own wants and wishes and preferences into the table. Or like Björn Wahlöö said, they bring dirt on the floor of the bank. If nothing else, they wear out the hinges of the door.
So you need to account for many different kinds of possible customer inputs to your service.
Exactly,
system.
And that's what's called an flexibility, or the technical term in industrial management, robustness. So we have to design the production system to be robust, so it can deal with this kind of external disturbances or a wide variety of demand situation. So think of society. There are certain services that are explicitly designed to deal with almost everything. So that's, for example, emergency medicine or the police. It's sort of the society's ultimate, the buck stops here. If that's the case that nobody wants to touch, then at the end you call the police because they have to make some standpoint. And emergency medicine clinics have the sort of specific design that makes it possible for them to deal with all the sort of random, whatever, incredible things that happens to people's health at any time of the day. So they have to be people at work over the night. They have to be teams with different specialties. They need to have a very strict sense of urgency, so that if some extremely urgent patient comes in, then they just sort of stop whatever they're doing with somebody who is not an urgent case and everybody rushes to take care of the maximum urgent case. So this is a thing that has to be designed especially, because in normal circumstances you don't do that. You process customers in the order they come in. But here you have to change
the
priorities according to the situation. So that kind of flexibility has to be built into the system.
And this also sounds to me like this has implications from the service productivity viewpoint, especially if we compare closed systems like manufacturing.
Mm-hmm.
So it's
closed systems are always much more productive by definition, because they deal with less variability, or they can exactly define what kind of inputs they are accept, and then because the system is closed, then there's less disturbances in the near environment, from which follows then that the speed of processing can be increased, and the steerability or the level of control over the things can.
Yeah, so this also explains the slower growth in service sector.
Yeah, it's part of it. Yeah, because if you have to make individual setups every time you produce a service, then for obvious reasons that's going to take some time and incur some cost.
Okay, thank you, Paul.
Thank you.